You're listening to Slow Theology, Simple Faith for Chaotic Times, with A.J. Swoboda and E.J. Gupta. Welcome, everybody, to Slow Theology, Simple Faith for Chaotic Times. I'm E.J. Gupta here with my friend A.J. Swoboda, and we are going to address the topic of Christian heroes. It's just a part of our faith that we're going to gravitate towards people we admire, people we look up to, heroes, leaders. Lately in the news, it's very easy to become cynical as we read the news about all these Christian pastors, musicians, legends, writers, academics that have fallen from grace. And it's raised really the question, should we have heroes? And so I feel like sometimes we're caught in two extremes. One is we worship these Christian leaders like gods. And then the opposite would be we just want to be Lone Ranger Christians. We just want to be left alone. AJ, you're famous.
Sister.
No, I'm just kidding. But, you're someone who has an interesting story because you're pretty young and younger than me. You've written books, you've done, long-term pastoral ministry. It's kind of easy. We've talked about this before privately. It's easy to get caught up in a culture of celebrity, in a culture of, I want a platform. I want to be important and special. I want other people to want to be me or want to be like me. I'm not saying that you're like that, but I'm saying we both recognize there are kind of haves and have-nots when it comes to platform. Mm-hmm. How do you process that? Because I know when you were living in Portland, where you lived for a while, you were known by people. I don't know if you know this, AJ, but you were someone pretty darn special.
Wow.
And now people are like, where does he live? What is he doing? Who does he work for? And who the heck is Bushnell? We love you, Bushnell, by the way. Thanks for sponsoring our podcast. But this whole celebrity thing, I'm gonna confess something and then I want to turn it over to you. I'm one of these people growing up where I just love putting posters up on the wall.
Yeah.
Looking up to people. I love that question. If you could have dinner with somebody, who would it be? I love that. I love heroes.
Yeah.
And so I feel really ambivalent because there's all these interesting conversations coming out right now about the dangers of celebrity and status. So it sounds like you've been kind of on a journey of processing this too. What's it like for you?
Well, I appreciated what you said. I'm so glad we're having this conversation. I appreciate what you said about the two, these two polar opposites that tend to be very dangerous in the extremes. On one side, we have a faith where we unhealthily isolate, highlight. In Christian culture, we would say put somebody on a pedestal. This sort of approach where we raise up a person to an unhealthy level. But Nijay, on the other hand, there's an equally dangerous approach towards having a hero in the faith, and that is that you don't have any, and you are the sum total of all things. You've become essentially your own hero, and you don't have anybody else that you're following. And I think, you're as a, preeminent New Testament scholar, you would say, actually, the New Testament has, in a way, a critique of both. That on one hand, in the book of Acts, for example, we have all these occasions when Paul or an apostle will come into a city, and everybody tries to worship them. Yeah. And then Paul or whoever will say, no, you don't worship me. I'm not the Jesus guy. But then on the opposite side, Paul writing, for example, to the church in Corinth and saying things like this, some of you look to Apollo, some of you look to these heroes. And then he makes a comment that there's there's a group of people that just looks to Jesus, and they don't have anybody beyond that. And they don't have anybody that they're following. When Paul, of course, says very clearly, follow me as I follow Jesus. Like he wants us. We need heroes, but what we need is not to worship our heroes. We need the right heroes and good heroes, but we need to not worship those heroes. I know this, you know, that my time in Portland was a remarkable season for the last 4 years, 3.5 years, have lived in Eugene. It's been a much quieter life, and it was a very intentional transition. But I can tell you pretty quickly when I am unhealthy, when I do pretty much one of two things. When I'm unhealthy, the first thing that I do when I log on to my computer is when I immediately log into my Amazon account and find out what ranking I am for a particular book. Right. Because it turns out, for those who haven't written, you know, in Amazon, you can find out what your ranking is, and you can find out how the book is doing pretty quickly. I'm very unhealthy when that becomes the focal point of my day. Mm. And I'm equally unhealthy when, as an Enneagram 3, I immediately go to the realm of how many invitations I'm getting to, right, to do something, be it speak or write or something like that. And I can just tell when those things become the focal point of my existence, that the sort of the false self in me is being fed to an and it's gaining too much life in me. And so I can affirm, actually, as somebody who's I'm not a celebrity, but I can affirm that there have been times in my life where I've been really tempted to go in that direction, for some not good reasons and some for some great reasons. I think this is why it's really hard, actually, to look into your own heart and see that, man, sometimes our drive to want to be known is connected to good stuff. We want people to know God. We want people to know Jesus. I want people to know God. That's a healthy motivation, but it can often be paired with dark motivation. And so our hearts are a little bit like the parable of the field, with it's got a lot of wheat grown, but a lot of weeds grown too. And so it's hard to navigate the difference between those two things.
Well, let me ask you this. I read this book recently, which it's just provided a lot of food for thoughts by, you know, Caitlin Beatty, called Celebrities for Jesus.
Oh, good.
And I heard everybody talking about it, so I had to buy it. So I bought it, it arrived, and I read it in about 24 hours. It's not a super long book, but I grew up in the exact same Christian culture as Beatty. CCM and, you know, DC Talk and, you know, all the celebrity pastors and, you know, Max Lucado and all of that. On the one hand, I found it very insightful. On the other hand, I feel bad that I was totally bought into worshiping and honoring these celebrities. Here's what I wrestle with, because you and I are in this world where we write books and we have a podcast, for example, and we get interviewed a lot for various reasons. People look to us as thought leaders, thinkers, experts in various areas. We have plenty of detractors and plenty of people that don't know who we are and don't like us. But I guess after reading the book, it made me feel bad. It made me feel bad that I'm a part of an unhealthy system. Because I get paid advances and I get royalties. And I know Caitlin is not saying I shouldn't get royalties.
Right.
But because I have X number of Twitter followers, I get a book deal and someone else doesn't. And she talks about meritocracy. And meritocracy, if listeners don't know, is the idea of some people have kind of worked so hard they deserve their platform, and yet, you know, there's some question about how much they've actually done to deserve that and how much we should rate that platform. But here's what I keep going back to, kind of what you just said. And it's this word that we sometimes feel ambivalent about, ambition. That's what I really want to talk about, because I feel like so much of my pursuit of writing is ambition. But sometimes people use that as a dirty word. Yeah. I'll tell you a story, which is tragic back then, but funny now. So I was working at Seattle Pacific University. I was on a 2 or 3 year contract. So I was looking for a permanent job. And I'd interviewed for some jobs at a conference, and I came back to Seattle. And my dean, who was trying to help me out, wonderful guy, he sat down with me in his office, and he said, I've been talking to some of the schools that you're interviewing at. I said, great. What did they say? He said, they said you're ambitious. I said, wonderful. He said, no, that's not a good thing. And he said, that's not a good thing to be ambitious. Huh. And that was kind of a wake up call for me. Like, oh shoot, I didn't know I'm being ambitious was a bad thing. But I think what they were saying is I'm trying too hard. I'm not 100% sure exactly why ambition, but we can see that if someone is trying too hard, that comes across a certain way. Maybe they're they just need to chill out or whatever. I don't know.
But ambition,
a good or bad thing?
Well, I mean, again, I'm talking to somebody who knows the New Testament pretty darn well. Correct me if I'm wrong. Aren't there like really important moments where Paul actually commands us to be ambitious people? I mean, for example, First Thessalonians 4, make it your ambition to lead a quiet life.
Yeah.
Like ambition, this sense of like, make it your life's purpose. Yeah. Drive passionate everything pursuit. Towards this thing, towards a good ambition. The problem is not ambition in itself, is it? It's the problem. The thing is like what we're ambitious for. Are we doing this because we seek fame and glory and the riches and wealth of the work that we're doing, or are we doing it because we are ambitious to see as many people have a deep encounter with the living God as possible? The problem for me, Nijay, is sometimes those ambitions can go beyond the banks of the river and can get, I'm ambitious for too much, and I'm ambitious for things that are not my own. I think you made a, I was struck that you said that you feel bad, or that you feel like almost a sense of dirtiness that you used to be kind of in this world.
I do.
And that's I think I can resonate with that. Although I didn't become a Christian until I was 16 years old. Isn't part of this developmental? I mean, as a kid, right? Any kid, usually kids, I think most kids like have a really high view of their parents. You look up to your dad, you look up to your mom, and you look up to these people who I remember as a kid, like walking in and seeing my dad shave and think like, I'd caught him in his glory, you know, like he could have been, Santa Claus. I mean, he was the coolest guy. He needs to shave. I looked up to my dad with such,
reverence. Yeah.
And then you grow up and you begin to see, little snippets of your parents, and you go like, you're not that. Oh, and then, this is what college is and early adulthood is you see your parents, start to see your parents more as peers and less as the heroes. Isn't that like healthy? Like a healthy developmental process where we, for a season, we do need a hero, but that the older we become, the less and less and less we rely on those heroes to the same degree that we used to.
Yeah, that does make a lot of sense. I think some of this is personality oriented. You and I are both threes. Yeah. And I think threes naturally have people that they want to emulate. And that can cross a line into some unhealthy territory of envy. You know, I could tell you from the academic standpoint, I'm telling listeners, not you, AJ, but I could tell you there's a lot of academic envy that goes on at conferences and a lot of gossip and a lot of, you see these professors in your classrooms and you think, oh, they're just the most wonderful people in the world. And then you get to these conferences and it's this, eat or be eaten. I get kind of sick of the academic conferences because of the, mean-spirited comments at, sessions and things like that. But in general, like, I loved going to these academic conferences and saying, oh, there's Richard Hayes or there's Beverly Gaventa. I want to go talk to them. I want to get their autograph, you know, whatever it is. Like, I never have grown out of that. I guess I'm saying I haven't grown out of it, AJ. I haven't grown out of it. I still am like totally fanboying.
We're all on a developmental journey. You're arriving. You're arriving. I remember, I got to tell you this, a couple years ago. I was speaking a thing and I had somebody come up. This was the only time this ever happened, but a kid came up to me and asked me to sign his Bible.
Whoa.
And that was the lowest moment I think in my entire journey.
The question is, AJ, did you sign his Bible?
I did sign it.
Oh boy.
And I wanted to go back and find that kid True and confessions. Apologize through and through and through. But I signed
it. Did you sign as AJ or did you sign it as God? That would be the next
I think
level.
I wrote something like, I'm not God and I didn't write this, but I hope you read it, AJ Swoboda, or something like
okay.
that.
Okay, that's safe.
But the reality, I mean, this is the human flesh. Like, this is all of us. This is a part, whether you're an academic or you're a theologian, a teacher, it doesn't matter. Like, everybody has this on some level inside of us, a desire for to chase somebody. And I don't know, part of me thinks it's developmental and it's part of health. Part of me thinks it's, you know, the realm of sin. I don't know. It's a fine line between the two. I do know this. Isn't it, Nijay? I mean, just how many times we see Jesus in the Gospels after doing some incredible miracle, do everything in his power to have nobody talk about it.
Yeah.
To go to another town and say, don't tell anybody that this happened. The messianic secret idea, right? That Jesus did not want to be known through his celebrity. He wanted to be known for other things. And he wanted to be known because he was all about the Father. He didn't want to do the fireworks. He didn't want it to be about that. And we live in, right in this moment where the one guy, what do we call it when somebody thinks that they're all that? We call it the messianic complex. The one person in the world, in human history, who should have the Messiah complex, but didn't, was Jesus.
Yeah.
Right? Totally. And we, you know, the Messianic, what if the Messianic secret was a way of life? What if that was a way that we lived?
Yeah.
It's astounding how that would look.
Well, one thing that Beatty talks about in her book, which was super helpful for me, I mean, you know, you and I, again, we're not super important, but we end up being in the spotlight because we're teachers. Because we're writers. So I'm trying now to just think through how do we do this in a really healthy way? If this is, you know, rather than just sequestering ourselves and hiding in the desert, how do we do this in a healthy way? One thing that Bay talks about is the problem of isolation. That in order to retain this image of perfection, you isolate yourself from other people. That was actually a really good diagnostic for me. You know, do I have close friendships? Do I have, you know, am I one person when I'm on a, you know, a YouTube interview? Am I a different person when I'm, you know, out and about? This idea of authenticity, you know, I think those are really important. People are looking at your life and they're looking at your consistency and integrity and things like that. So some of that are things that I'm kind of keenly aware of. You know, what questions should we be asking as we think about, you know, who we should be emulating as just simple followers of Jesus, AJ? Who should we be? What kind of things should we be processing? Because, you know, one thing that Beatty talks about is, you know, these wealthy pastors with, you know, expensive sneakers. And, you know, obviously that's not what we should be emulating. But how do we choose our heroes wisely if we're going to have them anyway? And people like me are. How do we do it wisely?
Yeah. Well, part of this. How do you select your heroes? How do you know what are the people that we intentionally choose to follow, lead, and allow to shape into our life? I would have used to have said to somebody who needed therapy, I would have said, you need a therapist. I don't say that anymore. I don't tell people to get a therapist anymore. I tell people that they need a good therapist. Because there are a lot of bad therapists out there. And I wouldn't tell somebody to get spiritual direction. I would say you need a good spiritual director because there are a lot of bad spiritual directors out there. And I certainly wouldn't say you need a pastor. You need a good pastor. So what is that thing? You know, what is the thing that marks somebody different from? And part of this probably is a bit subjective and maybe that's the risk we run. But I do think to begin, I think that one of the most important things we can ask about somebody that we're going to follow is having a real conversation about, has this person shown themselves over a long period of time to have character to handle my story? Does this person, I mean, this is of course one of the dangers of Paul writes about. He says, don't take a new convert and make him a person of authority in the church. There's wisdom in that. Yeah. There's wisdom in not taking somebody that's super young and giving them a huge amount of pressure, because usually at that young stage, you can't handle that kind of pressure. It's too much. And usually only the wrinkles of one's faith over 30, 40 years can handle the depth of high levels of stress and pressure. So I do think part of this is that in evangelical culture, we just throw young people up on stage and hope they stick, like we're throwing spaghetti on a refrigerator in hopes that that a few of them will stick. And the reality is there is a huge subculture of people that got thrown on the refrigerator and they didn't stick, and it really hurts. So we've got to stop using young people as a marketing ploy and start putting people in positions that can handle it, who have. Totally. So here's my point. This is why Eugene Peterson pastored more people than he could ever imagined, because he had a lifetime, lifetime character, a long obedience in the same direction of living something out long term. I think the most authority in our lives should be given to people whose lives are worthy of that level of followership. So to speak. Well, I mean, when you looked at Paul, if you were to meet Paul and looked at the scars on his back from the times he was beaten and ripped apart, you'd go, this guy has earned the right to speak into my life. Yeah. Look at those scars. So we need people with scars that have, you know, over a period of time. I don't know. What do you think, Nijay? I think that's a good starting place.
Yeah, that resonates with me. I mean, you know, I teach, you know, regularly I teach courses on, you know, the New Testament evidence for church leadership. And one of the key terms is elders, and literally the word elder means old person. I mean, we think of elder as a technical term because we don't use it today very often in kind of day-to-day life. But the whole idea of an elder is they have earned a voice over a lifetime of obedience and wisdom and experience. And this idea that, you know, you might bring in like a 21-year-old.com CEO to be an elder in your church doesn't resonate with that ancient mentality that, you know, it takes decades to kind of understand that, you know, the fine textures of life. So I think you're absolutely right. I think what we can differentiate is talent and life earned wisdom. You know, an 80-year-old music prodigy can have lots and lots of talent.
Yep.
And we can pay for a concert and we can admire that, but that's different than treating them as a spiritual hero.
Yep. Yep.
I like that.
Well, I think you, when I teach, I've noticed a difference between when I'm teaching a master's level course and a doctor of ministry course. And I've noticed that for master's level courses, when I'm teaching a group of students who generally tend to be between 25 and 30, usually in a lot of the environments that I'm in, at least, is usually that group of people have way more knowledge than life experience.
Yeah.
And they tend to know way more than they've actually
That's
lived
a good
out.
Point. Yeah.
Whereas doctor of ministry students, they tend to have way more life experience and they're trying to find the knowledge to meet up to that. And I've got to say,
that's a good way to put it.
Between those two groups is a doctor of ministry group tends to have a lot more humility because they made a lot more mistakes.
Yeah.
And so we need leaders who have made a lot more mistakes actually doing the work of Jesus rather than people who have a theoretical framework for how to live things out. Let me throw this at you too, Nijay. Tell me what you think about this. So number one, like people who have scars, wisdom, they've gone before us. Mm-hmm. Secondly, I think this really matters. I think that we should follow leaders who actually like love Jesus. Yeah. And when I say love Jesus, not mean like that they have necessarily all their doctrine in line, but like, call me crazy, but like they go to church. And they like
that is crazy.
They like serve in the children's ministry. They don't just have an academic love for God. They have an affect of love for God. Like when you're with them, like they want to pray for you. They want to talk about how's your discipleship looking? Like how is your, because it's easy. I always remembered somebody told me a story. They got to meet their theological hero, Colin Gunton, who is an Anglican theologian. Yeah. One of my favorites. I still love Gunton's work. But they said the thing that changed him the most was they went and visited his church. And nobody in his church knew that he was famous outside the church. And he was always the guy that was washing dishes after donut hour after church.
Yeah. That's a good,
I heard that story, and it made me want to follow Gunton all the more because I want to follow the person who does the dishes because they love the church and they love God's people. I don't know. What do you think about that? Like the affect of a love for Jesus.
Yeah. I think the challenge is we don't always know. Often our heroes are at a distance. So maybe another way of putting it, AJ, is we need to have heroes that we can observe. It's fine to love the person, you know, that is, you know, 2,000 miles away. But you should have local heroes so that you can actually get a glimpse of their life as well.
Ooh, I like that. A local hero and a digital hero with the difference between the two, or a hero from afar and a local hero, that we need both. It's okay to love N.T. Wright, but I don't get to call N.T. Wright up and talk about my week with you know, my struggles with my marriage or whatnot. We need local people who we look up to as well as the distant hero. Ooh, I like that.
Yeah. And we tend to gravitate towards heroes that are far and beyond us. You know, if we're at level 2, they're at level 200.
Yeah.
But in another sense, we need heroes that are just at level 5, level 6. You know what I mean? I think that shows that sense of there aren't tiers of importance. It also shows, you know, I can actually move towards being better in these areas, just like this person who's just a few steps ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Okay. So I gave two. I gave, like, number one, they've got some track record. They've got time, character, scars, an affect for Jesus. What for you, when you're looking at somebody that you want to follow, what matters to you, Nijay, as maybe a third idea? What's something that's really important for you?
I would say humility. You know, in celebrity, there's so much narcissism. And so, you know, just a sense of self-examination. You know, I follow, obviously, a lot of people on social media. And I don't know if you ever noticed this. You're not on social media a ton, AJ. But every now and again, I will talk about my failures. Recently, I just had two articles rejected in the same month for publication. And I just say that because I wish people would have said that more when I was kind of coming up. Just to say, this happens to everybody. It's normal. It's embarrassing. It hurts when it happens, but I'm going to move on. And it's funny, people jumped in and said, oh, it's okay. And I didn't do it to invite pity. But I want to kind of deconstruct and break down this assumption that just because I write books, I'm perfect. Or just because I write books, I never experience rejection. So I want to see that, you know, some of those admissions, you know, kind of peeling back the curtain, the veneer of perfection, and just saying, hearing from these heroes saying, you know, I wasn't my best self yesterday and that was okay. Or I experienced rejection too. I'll tell you, it means a lot to people to hear from people they respect and admire that they go through periods of rejection.
Yeah.
And failure even, and just to normalize that. I do this to normalize failure. So anyway, I want to see humility out of them. I want to see admission of guilt. I messed up. I think that tells me something about that person's journey.
Wow. Okay, Nijay, we've got like 3 minutes left, but I remember this one story. I remember this one time. I was a brand new Christian, maybe 2-3 years. And a hero of mine, who had become a hero of mine, a local hero, said to me once, he said, you know, I've never really struggled with sexual temptation. And I said, what do you mean by that? And he goes, I've never looked at pornography, and I've never struggled with masturbation or whatnot. And he said that to me, and it was birthed out of a good place. He was saying, like, He's walked in freedom in this area. And I just, you know, you can't help but praise God in that. But I remember that in a weird way, that really wounded me.
Mm.
And it wounded me because it set up the precedent in my mind that if I was to ever experience a form of sexual temptation, that he could never identify with me in that. And I could never talk to him about that. And it almost created this in me, if that became a thing, that I couldn't, there was a ceiling to my call,
a barrier, or something like yeah.
that. And hearing you say, actually, people need in their leaders, they need their leaders to name their struggle, because if you don't, then you can't follow them. I mean, you need a leader who's gone before you in the things that you yourself struggle with. And the best heroes are the ones who have the hardest stuff on the geography of their map. They're willing to name it. I've always loved in the Old Testament that the names of the cities in the Old Testament are always names of the hard things that happened there.
right.
We'll name them like after yeah. like something horrible happened there. I just love that they're put on the maps.
Yeah.
They're
yeah.
there. They're not like, they don't whitewash it. It's like, it's there. Yeah. It's named. Waters of bitterness, you know?
yeah, yeah. It's bad things need to be remembered too. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's awesome. Humility. Okay. So this has been a really good conversation, EJ. I hope everybody who's listening to this knows it is okay to have heroes.
Totally.
You need heroes, but it is also dangerous to worship your heroes.
Totally.
And yeah. I want to give a shout out to my Catholic friends. I'm not a Catholic, but my Catholic friends are always telling me that they are frustrated that evangelicals think that Catholics worship Mary, and they don't worship Mary. They venerate Mary.
They admire
and
her.
Yeah. They go out of their way to say there's a difference between worshiping somebody and following somebody. Mm-hmm. And I want to channel a little of my Catholic sentiment there. I'm not Catholic, but there's a difference between worshiping a hero and venerating a hero. And we got to be very careful to not do the first. But it's okay to have heroes that we follow in the faith. Lord knows we need them.
Totally.
Yeah. EJ, great conversation today.
Yeah, I learned something. Thanks.
I did too. Yeah. Amen and amen. All right. Grace, peace. Hey, thanks for listening to Slow Theology. If you want to leave a ratings, that would be awesome. We definitely love that. But other than that, friends, God's grace and peace. And we hope you find simple faith for chaotic times.